It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a survey of students at UW-Madison found that members of minority groups are less likely than their peers to feel like they belong on campus. We'll look at those results and what's being done to help improve the campus climate. First, House Republicans passed their tax overhaul bill yesterday. The bill passed with a comfortable margin, with 227 votes in favor, 205 opposed. No Democrats voted in favor of the measure. If President Trump and other Republicans get their way, the bill will be on the president's desk before the end of the year. But the GOP's effort to reform the tax code is hitting more roadblocks in the Senate. One critic so far is Wisconsin's own Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Bernie Becker is a tax reporter for Politico. He joins us now to share the latest on the Republican tax legislation. Bernie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the Republican House plan. Can you give us some of the highlights of what they ended up passing?
Yeah, so the centerpiece for both pieces of legislation is cutting the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%. That's something that President Trump has said is his red line. That's the central thing he wants. On the individual side, it cuts some taxes for most people, but it also has some family credits that would expire and some changes in the state and local incentives, but would allow people to still write off their property taxes.
And then different organizations and government bodies are trying to score these measures as they come along. What are we seeing as far as who would feel a positive benefit, a negative impact from what the House passed?
Right. And so the way this was written was that it's written for a $1.5 trillion tax cut for the first 10 years of this. It's one of the things, it's a beauty in the eye of the beholder thing. It would be a tax cut for all groups, according to most analyses, but there would be some people within those groups, especially in the middle class, that would see a tax increase. So it's both sides have been able to find reasons to either praise or oppose this legislation because of those findings.
Now, the House has passed a thing, and the Senate is working on a thing that made it through a committee. Those two things are not identical, and that's important. What are the key differences between the two plans?
Right. I think it is fair to say that there are sort of broad similarities. This is not, sometimes when the House and the Senate are working on two different things, they can be very far apart. They both cut the corporate rate by the same amount. There are some differences on the mortgage interest deduction. The House cuts that while the Senate doesn't. There is, individual tax brackets, international tax rules for sort of how businesses would be taxed on their offshore income, very sort of weedy in stuff there. And also the sort of how they would tax businesses that aren't corporations. And that's actually what Ron Johnson's main criticisms have been. Those are also very different. He actually doesn't like either of them. So there are a fair amount of differences on both the individual side and the corporate side.
Yeah, let's listen to Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson talking about that issue on CNN yesterday.
The folks who wrote the framework for this tax reform realize that if we're going to make American businesses globally competitive, which we must do, it's table stakes, we need to make sure that every American company remains competitive, and we can't leave the pass-through businesses behind.
So talk about that. There are different kinds of businesses and business tax cuts. So what has Senator Johnson concerned here?
Right. So, I think when a lot of people think of businesses, they think of corporations, but that's less than 10% of all companies in the U.S. So there are a lot of businesses that as he was saying, pass-throughs, they pay taxes to the individual system. That could be like your neighborhood hardware store, your corner store, but it could also be sort of very large law firms, hedge funds, those sorts of places. So what Ron Johnson has been saying is that, yes, it's a great thing to cut the corporate rate down to 20%, but in the process, you're leaving behind some of those individual businesses or those businesses that pay through that individual system. So he's concerned that the way both the House and the Senate have structured this now, those companies would be paying, upwards to 30%, maybe even more than that. And that's a pretty big difference between the 20% rate you're seeing on the corporate side. He wants to see a closer delta there. And it's a very difficult thing to write because you don't want to allow people to abuse that pass-through rate so as to be to say it's business income when it's actual wage income. So as you can see, it gets very complicated. But the problem is that he thinks that those pass-through businesses have been left behind in this sort of rush to slash the corporate rate.
And what's been the response from Republicans? I know here in Wisconsin, Congressmember Sensenbrenner said something about Senator Johnson. These are in the same party now, said he was strutting like a peacock, stepping forward to do this instead of negotiating more behind the scenes.
I think there is sort of a memory of how Senator Johnson handled the health care debate in the Senate. He was sort of out there very early as someone who had issues and sort of a squeaky wheel on that. Eventually, he came into line. I mean, I think this is, you know, this is something that people talked about as being a potential issue when we just knew what the framework of this plan was going to be, that this was sort of making sure that those pass-through businesses were sort of, you know, helped as much as corporations were, was something that was going to be a very important thing. And so I do think they're going to have to make changes, or it's potentially they'll have to make changes to sort of appease him. And I think there are others who may be, you know, quieter than Johnson, but also have some issues there. So I think you can expect to see some changes. You know, the Senate bill is not a finished product yet. But I do think you do get a sense there are some Republicans who don't like how publicly sort of Johnson handles what could be internal disagreements, you know?
Talking to Bernie Becker from Politico, looking at tax overhaul efforts in both houses of Congress. You mentioned the Affordable Care Act there, and that was a recent change now in the Senate tax bill eliminating the individual mandate. That is not in the House version of this, so what happens there?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, the House has always been more aggressive on health care, certainly this year, and they had said that they didn't want to include the individual mandate just because of how controversial it was and how, you just saw how their health care efforts went. The Senate basically decided that it needed this adds more than $300 billion you can use the $300 billion from eliminating the mandate to sort of put tax cuts elsewhere. And so that's something they decided they needed to do because, you know, a permanent corporate rate of 20% is expensive. So they used that to sort of beef up some of the other individual provisions to make it sort of seem more friendly to individuals and to sort of stave off the idea that this was largely driven by helping the corporate world and not the sort of middle class, which is the message they've been pushing.
And there was a long, difficult exchange in a Senate committee. I want to give a listen to Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown and Orrin Hatch from Utah, Republican, talking about the impact of the bill. Here's a little excerpt of that.
I just think it would be nice just tonight, before we go home, to just acknowledge, well, this tax cut really is not for the middle class, it's for the rich. And that whole thing about higher wages, well, it's a good selling point. But we know companies don't just give away higher wages. They just don't give away higher wages just because they have more money. Corporations are sitting on a lot of money now. They're sitting on a lot of profits now. I don't see wages going up. So just spare us the bank shots, spare us the sarcasm and the satire, and let's move.
I'm going to spare it, but I'm going to just say to you that I come from the poor people, and I've been here working my whole stinking career for people who don't have a chance. And I really resent anybody saying that I'm just doing this for the rich. Give me a break. I think you guys overplay that all the time, and it gets old. And frankly, you ought to quit it.
Mr. Chairman, the public believes
it. I'm not through.
He wasn't through. It went on awkwardly for a while there. This was a tense moment for a Senate committee meeting.
Right, and you know, Orrin Hatch especially is not known for being. I mean, he keeps his temper pretty well in control. So it was, it was very late as someone who was watching that. So I think a lot of people are surprised to see how that went down. But it does sort of speak to the tension of this, to sort of how badly Republicans feel like they need to get a tax bill done. They've got basically zero legislative accomplishments this year. It's less than a year now until they face voters again. And this was something where Democrats feel like they were not sort of allowed to play a role here, and this was something that was written by Republicans, going to be passed by the GOP. So it's sort of natural that the tensions would rise, especially sort of right before the vote.
And briefly, Bernie, a lot of this bill has been crafted to be passable by a simple majority, not a 60-vote majority. Mm-hmm. And what are the prospects for that happening as people are watching this over the next month or two?
Right. So the Senate is going to take that bill to the floor when they get back the week after Thanksgiving. And they can only lose two votes. And So it's sort of one of the thing that's always with watching them is there's a push and a pull. Adding in the mandate, you could see losing someone like Susan Collins. You know, there are people who are concerned about the debt this will cause. You got Ron Johnson. So they're likely going to have to do something to change the bill to assuage some of those concerns.
And we'll have to leave it there. Sorry, Bernie. Thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Bernie Becker, tax reporter for Politico. He joins us to look at the GOP tax plan that passed in the House and the Senate efforts to pass a similar bill. Right now, for students to get the most out of their college experience and have academic success, feeling a sense of belonging on campus can be crucial. A new survey of students at UW-Madison found that members of minority groups were less likely to feel welcome than their peers. Students of color, LGBTQ, and transgender students, and those with disabilities all reported feeling less welcome at the state's flagship university. They're also more likely to consider leaving the university and to have had threatening behavior directed at them. Sherry Charleston is the Interim Assistant Vice Provost at UW-Madison's Division of Diversity, Equity, and Educational Achievement. Sherry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Sherry, this survey looked at whether students felt welcome on campus, whether they felt they belonged on campus. What kind of things did we find out? What kind of differences did we see among different groups on campus?
Students reported considerable differences based on their backgrounds and identities. So, for instance, while 81% of students overall feel welcome on campus, the same is true for only 69% of LGBTQ students, 67% of students with a disability, and 65% of students of color, and then 50% of transgender non-binary students. We were concerned about that. We are concerned about that number. We noticed that about 1 in 10 students reported personally experiencing hostile, harassing, or intimidating behavior while at UW-Madison. So while, you know, the good news here is that 4 out of 5 students reported feeling very or extremely safe, welcome, and respected, and 70% feel like they belong, there are considerable numbers of students who don't have that same experience. And so our challenge is to make sure that all students have the same positive, welcoming, and wonderful experience while they're here on campus.
What difference does it make if a student doesn't feel welcome on campus and feel like they belong there? What does that affect their academic career?
Research has demonstrated for years that a student's sense of belonging, their ability to really focus on their academics is directly affected by the campus climate. And our concern was that we want this to be a campus. Our concern, the concern of the chancellor, the concern of the vice provost for diversity and inclusion, the concern is that we want this place to be a campus that is welcome for everyone, where everyone has an opportunity to thrive academically.
And no matter how you slice it, clearly students of color, transgender students felt less welcome, felt less like they belonged. Can you talk about some of the reasons that go into that at UW-Madison and probably other campuses?
Sure. I think there are a number of things that go into why a particular student doesn't feel like they belong. I'll tell you, some of the findings indicated, and some of the findings and the recommendations, let me say, indicated that students raised concerns about their experiences inside the classroom. There were also concerns about incidents of hate and bias on campus. So for us, part of the task is to think about how we make our classrooms in particular more inclusive environments. Similarly, making sure that we are responsive to incidents of hate and bias. The Dean of Students Office has been wonderful in that they have hired a full-time person to handle hate and bias reporting here on campus, and we're hoping that in the next iteration we'll start to see an increase in the number of reported incidents. Not to say that we want more incidents to occur, but that if there are incidents that are happening, that we are reporting them and that we are responding to them. And then that gives us a better opportunity to make sure that the number of incidents actually goes down by making sure that we're responsive to them. So for us, there's a sort of a you know, the goal going forward is going to be thinking about ways that we promote and improve the assessment of instructional best practices to make sure that our learning environments are inclusive, continuing to boost recruitment of underrepresented students, faculty, and staff, making sure that we retain them because we know that that has a direct impact on campus climate. And then, of course, the other piece is really increasing the capacity of students, faculty, and our staff to be able to intervene when there are instances of hostile harassment or hostile harassing or intimidating behavior, because we know that all of those things go into making our campus and our climate a lot safer.
A couple other groups that the report touched on were students from working class backgrounds, students who were maybe the first in their family to attend college or university. How can the university be a welcoming place for people who don't have that, you know, that family background? So maybe their parents could tell them what it's like to be on campus.
Well, we know that students, first-generation students, international students, transfer students, students from working-class background did report a less positive campus climate on some measures. The efforts that we're putting in place, the idea that we need to improve and provide more training and education related to diversity and inclusion, also applies to students who are first generation as well, making sure that we're thinking inclusively about diversity and really thinking through our responses in ways that are responsive to a wide variety of diverse populations, including students who are first generation. We've always said that our definition of diversity is a broad one, and it's an inclusive one, and making sure that all students on campus have a positive experience is not just referring to students of color. It's referring to all students on campus, including students who are first generation and who come from working class backgrounds. That's really the Wisconsin idea.
We're talking to Sherry Charleston from UW-Madison's Division of Diversity, Equity, and Educational Achievement about a new survey on whether students felt like they belonged on campus, like they felt they were welcome there. And Sherry, can you talk about programs either already going on at UW or in the works that might help address some of these concerns?
Sure. I think the thing that's important to remember is that the Campus Climate Survey was part of a larger initiative that started well before the survey itself. It was part of our Real Change implementation plan. And that Real Change document outlines a number of recommendations and a number of initiatives that we've been working to implement for several years now. I think most recently, many people are aware of some initiatives that we've launched over the past year, some new initiatives. So Our Wisconsin is in its second year. It's a community building program that aims to equip students with the skills to live and work effectively in a diverse world. It's actually been expanded and was offered to all incoming students this fall, up from 1,000 students in its pilot year, so we're extremely excited about that. The School of Education developed a discussion project, which is a professional development opportunity that will begin this fall to help faculty and academic staff members really facilitate high-quality classroom discussions that can engage all students. And we think this is an excellent training opportunity and an excellent initiative that that has been provided to teaching assistants and that we believe really has a lot of promise to impact the way we carry out our classroom instructional duties here on campus. The Black Cultural Center opened in May in the Red Gym, which was a great accomplishment, a wonderful event, and we're extremely excited about that. And then I mentioned before that the Dean of Students Office had created the full-time position of a bias response and advocacy coordinator last spring to oversee the university's bias reporting policies. So we're excited about all of these initiatives. We think that they are in line with what was outlined in the Real Change document. Some things are there's a lot of correlation between the results of the Campus Climate Survey and some of the things that we had already been working to do, and we're hoping We're hoping to gain some traction over the course of the next few years, but we're really excited that, one of the things that the survey indicated to us is that in many ways we're on the right track.
Chief Diversity Officer Patrick Sims said that change on this can't be top-down. It can't all come from the administration, that students need to be involved in helping find solutions. What kind of work would you like to see from students? What kind of contributions?
Absolutely. you know, diversity is everybody's responsibility. When we think about diversity, we oftentimes think of a sort of a top-down approach, and that's not what it is. We are a diverse campus, and we need to continually become more diverse. And, you know, we have been very fortunate to have students who've been very active throughout this process. We have several governance committees on campus that will be looking at these recommendations and plotting next steps. And from our perspective, students are an integral part of that. We're currently strategizing and thinking about what the plan is going forward. And one of the most crucial aspects is to make sure that there's a student voice at the table. So we'll continue to work with ASM. We'll continue to work with interested students on campus. Over the course of the next month, we're going to be having a series of talkback sessions. And the first one is coming up pretty soon on December 4th at the MSC, the Multicultural Student Center. We're hoping that we can get a lot of student feedback there. So hopefully if you have any student listeners who are interested in coming to the talkback session, they will join us and give them an opportunity really to talk to the staff and really think about what the path forward looks like.
Now, there could be students out there listening now or their parents thinking, all I care about is, does my kid get good classes? Do they get through? Do they get that degree? How does it benefit a student to be part of a diverse campus? What would you say to them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've seen for years more and more employers looking for students who have an ability to work with people from a variety of backgrounds. In my own courses, I'm constantly talking about how we have to think about things from a variety of different perspectives. We know it's connected to problem-solving ability, which is a key recruiting tool, a key recruiting metric. And so we really want to prepare students to be able to participate in a diverse workforce. And in order for that to happen, that means they have to get experience working in diverse learning environments and diverse communities.
We'll leave it there for now. Sherry, thanks a lot for taking the time. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Sherry Charleston is the Interim Assistant Vice Provost at the UW-Madison's Division of Diversity, Equity, and Educational Achievement. She talked with us about a new survey showing that minority students feel less welcome on the UW-Madison campus than the student body does as a whole. First, it's time for Food Friday, and if you're looking to take your cooking to a new level, here's a suggestion for you: sauce. Whether it's a simple tomato sauce or a creamy white sauce, there's a topping for just about every occasion, and it can bring a whole new dimension to classic dishes. Our next guest has written the definitive guide to sauce and has some advice on how you can make both classic and modern sauces in the comfort of your own kitchen and what you can pair these sauces with. James Peterson is a chef and a James Beard Award-winning food writer. He's written more than 15 books, including Sauces, Classical and Contemporary Sauce Making, now in its fourth edition. He joins us now. James, thanks a lot for joining us on Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you write in the book that sauce making can allow the cook more freedom to work with flavors, textures, and color than any other area of cooking. Tell us more about that.
Well, if you think about it, when you're baking something, if you bake a loaf of bread, for example, you mix everything in, you stick it in the oven, you hope it works. If it doesn't work, there's not much you can do until you make another loaf. Whereas with the sauce, you can manipulate it as it's going in real time. So if you've deglazed the pan and you've added a little cream or whatever and you want to wake it up with a drop of vinegar, or you decide you're going to add some freshly minced chives or whatever, they're very amenable to improvisation and adjustment such that they go with whatever you want them to go with.
And you start off with kind of a brief history of sauces, especially in the French tradition, going all the way back, though, to the ancient Greeks. We humans have been working with sauces and building on them for millennia, actually.
Yes, that's true. And the Romans used to use, it's funny, I've read a lot about Roman cooking, but the thing that seems almost universal was their use of fish sauce, which they called garum, or sometimes in Latin was liquidum. And they use this on everything. And it sounds, as best as I can reconstruct it, the way I read about how it was made and such, is it would be like Thai fish sauce and putting it on everything.
Huh. And
excuse me.
Well, I was going to say, I can be intimidated by, wanting to cook a sauce, especially kind of in that French classic tradition. And I came into your book feeling a little intimidated, too. But I got to say, there is some fancier stuff, but there's some stuff that I look at it and think, as a home cook, yeah, I could pull these off. It's not necessarily super complicated, too complicated for the average home chef, is it?
Not necessarily. And the point is, of course, the book is so big and heavy, it's intimidating.
It's
anyway.
Huge.
Looks kind of like a textbook. It's scary. But inside, what's really important is not so much the recipes or whether they're complicated or simple. The recipes are really there to illustrate the concepts. And what I tried to do in the book, more than just say, okay, mix a little of this, a little of that, make your sauce, I tried to say how you cook. Because to make a good sauce, you have to know how to cook. You can't just cook something and wreck it and make a little sauce and put it on. And you can. But it's important to know how to braise and roast and poach and all those things.
What are some basic pieces of equipment that, you know, somebody might not have in their home kitchen, but that would really make it a lot easier to tackle a lot of these recipes?
Well, it's not so much that you need special equipment. I like the thing that must remember is to get something heavy. That you don't want something thin, because it's very hard to control that. If you say you're reducing something in a thin pan, what happens is the heat all concentrates where the flame is. Whereas if you have a heavy bottom object, especially for copper, the heat is distributed smoothly and is even and doesn't burn in spots.
And talk about ingredients. You say you like this turn toward people going more and more to as fresh an ingredient list as possible. How much difference does that make in something like sauce?
Well, the funny thing about all this local stuff is that until very recently, that's how everybody cooked. That's out of necessity. It was all local. And in fact, it was in the 17th century, around that period in France, where they stopped cooking with spices and exotic ingredients from the Far East or the Mid East, and started cooking more locally with mushrooms and herbs. And that's where French cooking started to get its own identity.
And a big part of the philosophy you're working with, coming from that tradition, is, as you say, not contrasting necessarily with an exotic spice, but really taking your ingredient and magnifying, enhancing its own inherent flavor. How big a part of your sauce making is that?
Well, you nailed it on the head, because it's interesting, because I think what identifies a French sauce versus what, not universally, but often what defines a French sauce, is it does exactly what you just said. It underlines it. A good sauce should taste more like the thing than the thing itself. I make a lobster sauce that tastes more like lobster than anything you could chew on. So that's the goal, is to underline it. Nowadays, however, most people, and there's the other approach, which is to put things on the plate to contrast and accent what it is you're cooking. And I find that more common now. That's the trend now. If you go to one of these new restaurants and complicated food, and there'll be little condiments on the plate or little smears of things. It's rare to see a nice sauce, enough sauce that you can actually eat it.
We're talking to James Peterson about a new edition of his book, Sauces, Classical and Contemporary Sauce Making. Well, let's get into, again, maybe that person like me, James, who isn't a home saucier. What is a good, easy project for them to start with maybe this weekend?
Well, one thing I really love, what I really love is fresh mayo, homemade mayo. Because it's so versatile, you can add anything to it, and you can make, like, say you have some cold meats left over from the night before. You can make a basic mayo and then flavor it in so many ways, break it up into sections, divide it up, and flavor, like, with roast grilled peppers, with mushrooms, with herbs, with truffles, with saffron, with any number of things to make separate sauces out of the mayonnaise. Now, the thing about mayonnaise is it intimidates, because you have this initial period where you have to work the oil into the egg yolk, and that's the tricky thing, because you add too fast, or you're in a bad mood, or whatever. It's very, very tricky. it won't emulsify. You'll end up frustrated. So one of my tips is to take a couple tablespoons of bottled mayo, thin it with a little lemon juice, add an egg yolk for color more than anything, and whisk your oil into that, or stir your oil into that if it's olive oil. And that will, because you already have the emulsion set up by the commercial mayonnaise, you just stir it in. There's no big, complicated, hard, scary part at the beginning.
Well, I want to get into a recipe you shared with us for sauce. Pardon my French here, bechamel. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, bechamel.
Mm-hmm. So that's one of the sauces. We've got this up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What is that? What goes into it?
Well, nowadays, a bechamel is basically a roux to which you add milk, white roux, which is lightly cooked, butter and flour. Cook that for a couple of minutes until it smells good. Whisk in milk. Cook it till it comes to the simmer and boils. That's the flour won't really thicken until it boils. And then you flavor it, use a little cayenne and a little nutmeg. But my approach is somewhat different. When I take vegetables like onions and carrots and maybe some fresh thyme and sweat that in a heavy bottom pot and then add the flour to that, then add the milk. That will give you much more complexity. It'll give you much more nuance in your bechamel. And they used to make bechamel like that, so it's not completely heretical. It's just something I do that enhances it.
Okay, I've got this bechamel in hand now. Bechamel, what do I do with it? What kind of dishes, meats, say, could I serve it with?
Well, nowadays, bechamel, in the 70s and 60s, France, of course, went through this period of Nouvelle Cuisine where they banished flour from the kitchen. And bechamel was one of the victims. You rarely see it now. Usually they use cream instead. But I like bechamel most for gratin. For taking vegetables, lightly cooked vegetables like cauliflower, broccoli, what else? Green vegetables, and nap them with the cheese and put them in an oval gratin dish and a casserole and cover them with the bechamel and sprinkle it with cheese or add cheese to the bechamel, which turns it into a mayonnaise sauce. That's just nomenclature. It doesn't really matter. You add some cheese and spread it over the gratin and bake it. Well, that whole bechamel kind of, it gets brown and flavorful. It changes, and it's really lovely that way. But I don't use it as a sauce per se on a piece of fish, for example.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about sauces with chef and food writer James Peterson. He's out with a new edition of his classic cookbook, Sauces, Classical and Contemporary Sauce Making. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What sauce or sauces do you like to make in your kitchen? Is there a certain dish that benefits from having a great sauce? Do you have questions about, well, general questions about sauce making or particular ones about matching a sauce with a dish, how to make a particular kind of sauce? And hey, you restaurant chefs out there, call in with your signature sauce and share the secret. Well, you don't have to share the secret, but you can tell us about it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a couple recipes there, by the way, for that sauce bechamel and a cauliflower gratin. You could eat that in California. Sure, why not? A couple of recipes there, and you could share your thoughts, too. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation on Food Friday with James Peterson. He's a chef and a James Beard Award-winning food writer. He's written a lot of books, including Sauces, Classical and Contemporary Sauce Making. That's now out in its fourth edition. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your advice or maybe your questions on making a sauce. Is there something that is a surefire hit for you? Maybe you serve it up over the holidays or other special occasions? Or do you have a question about how to pull something off, something you'd like to try at home, maybe something you had at a restaurant that you want to try to replicate? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go right to your calls. Travis is online in Manitowish Waters. Travis, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Travis?
I had a question, not necessarily about sauce, but how to make French toast and waffles kind of more flavorful with a syrup or a butter or any kind of way to make them more delicious other than just maple syrup.
Travis, thanks. And you've got a whole section on dessert sauces and things like that. James, any advice for Travis?
Well, I'm such a fiend for maple syrup that it's hard to imagine anything better than that. The trick for me would be to get the best butter and the best syrup. But if you want a different sauce, as you're saying, serving waffles as a dessert, I don't know if you do that, Travis, or if you serve them for breakfast, or how exactly you serve them, but you can make a butterscotch sauce. You can make a caramel sauce. Those are very good on waffles. Then the caramel, I describe both of those in the book. It's kind of fun to make the caramel because you cook the sugar in a pot until it turns red, melts and turns red, and then you add liquids to it depending on what you're making. So that's exciting. Fruits, of course, fruit coulis, which are basically purees that have been strained. Those are very nice because an acidic raspberry puree or coulis will be nice next to something sweet because the acidity and the relative lack of sugar balance something sweet is very nice. So those would be a few of my whipped cream, maybe. A few of my tips.
Travis, thanks a lot for that call. Gives an excuse to try lots of French toast and waffles to experiment with those. You can call in at 800-642-1234, by the way. And James, of course, we've got Thanksgiving coming up next week. A lot of people are thinking about the various dishes, including the gravy. Do you have some advice on making a great straight-up gravy or maybe a distinctive twist on it?
Do you know in the first edition of the book there was no gravy?
Oh, wow.
And my brother, it was Thanksgiving. He's like, okay, I'm going to look up Jim's sauce book and find the gravy. It wasn't there. He was the one who alerted me to it. Now there is gravy. But the thing about gravy is that in order to make it well, you have to cook the turkey just right. You have to do all these, you have to build up to it. You can't just sort of in a vacuum make the gravy because it's based on turkey juices. Now, there's an inherent problem with this, because if you cook the turkey the way I say to cook it, which is much less than most people say, you're not going to get any juices. Because when a bird or a roast is properly cooked, not overcooked, there are no juices. Which is, what do you do, you know? So what I do is I take turkey parts, like wings or backs or whatever is a cheap thing, and put them in the roasting pan underneath the turkey with a piece of onion chopped up, maybe a carrot in there. And that functions in a couple of ways. Those pieces will release juices, whereas the turkey won't, and that'll provide you the gravy base. It also functions as a way of holding the turkey up so it doesn't stick to the pan. Now, a lot of people use a rack to prevent that, which I don't recommend, because if you have a rack and the juices start to drip out, they land on the roasting pan and burn. Because the roasting pan is the temperature of the oven, whereas the juices are 200-some degrees Fahrenheit. So you start cooking the turkey that way, and then when the turkey's done, you cook that base a little more if you need to, and you deglaze it with a little broth. I don't want to make this sound complicated. It doesn't need to be. But what I do is deglaze a little broth, boil it down, caramelize it, do it again. And then deglaze it a final time, strain it, and that's the jus. And the jus is basically a gravy that hasn't been thickened yet. That's all it is. So when you see roast something, oh, jus, that's all it is. But for Thanksgiving, we like gravy. So I make a little roux with flour and butter, or sometimes a little of the duck fat that I've skimmed off somewhere, and cook that until it's caramelized. Then I add the broth or the juices and simmer that a little bit. And then the giblets, I love giblets in there, so I take the giblets and surround the bird with it during cooking, with them during cooking, so the liver, the heart, whatever you can find, an egg. And then I chop those, not too fine, but very, very fine. And stir that into the jus and season it. And it's a delicious thing. Now, people worry about lumps. I always hear this lump thing. Just strain it. If you get lumpy gravy, stir it around as best you can and strain it. That's all. It'll fix it.
I don't mind the lumps, actually. We're talking to James.
Like flour, lumps of flour.
Yeah, I can live with that. I'm not too fussy. We're talking to James Peterson. His new book, or new edition of his book, is out, Sauces, Classical and Contemporary Sauce Making. We heard from Chris on Facebook. Chris writes, I worked in a northern Italian restaurant. We had a blue cheese cream sauce with walnuts that was served over ravioli. Now, James, that sounds pretty good to me. I'd be worried about it being maybe too rich, blue cheese and cream together. How would you make that so it still maybe is a little light?
I would do that. However, whenever I see blue cheese, the word blue cheese, mm-hmm. I don't buy it. Because blue cheese, there is some awful blue cheese out there. Like, I won't name names because I don't want to get in trouble in some way, but there, some blue cheeses are just vile, I find. So I like to be more specific. And in this case, I'd use Gorgonzola because it has a more distinct care. It has a distinct identity of its own. And I think it's fine to dissolve it in a little cream. Just don't use too much cheese and don't reduce it too much so it's gloppy or thick. Make it delicate. Don't make it too rich or thick. That makes sense?
Yeah, I think really? So. Chris, thanks for that suggestion. And James, here's something I hear that I think I'm never going to make that. A red wine reduction sauce. I've had that in, you know, restaurants, fine. That seems like it's out of my league. How can a home chef make a good wine reduction sauce?
Well, the secret to this whole sauce thing, if you're really serious and you want to make sauces really as good as anywhere, you have to make glace de viande. And glace de viande is basically broth that you cook way down. So it's when it's hard, when it's cold, it's like hard rubber. That's how reduced it is. It's a weekend project. You buy, I don't know, 20, 30 pounds of bones from the butcher, order them, knuckle bones. Don't get marrow bones. Get knuckle bones. Roast them with vegetables, with mirepoix, with carrots and onions. A little bouquet garni, a little bundle of herbs, and simmer that. You simmer that about 12 hours, very gently, and you skim off the fat that rises to the top. I explain it in detail in the book. And then you strain it, and you reduce it down. You keep skimming and skimming and reduce it and change it to smaller pots, and you end up with maybe a cup or two of this stuff.
Wow.
However, when it's time to make your sauce, you just put a little of that in there, and you have instant super sauce. Like, so for your red wine reduction, you don't want to just reduce red wine because that's going to be tannic and sour and not good at all. But if you reduce the red wine with a tablespoon or a teaspoon of the glaze, it'll cook down. And when it's cooked down, it's delicious. It's like a bordelaise. And then I usually finish it with a little butter, swirling a little butter, it depends how much you make, obviously, but a small proportion. And another tip, which sounds kind of decadent, I guess, and extravagant, but I use French butter because it took me years to understand why my sauces weren't tasting like they taste in France. I was so frustrated, and then I realized it was the butter. So I use French butter for that, if I have it. Otherwise, I don't.
And, James, we just have a few moments left. You've got so many sauces to work with here. I assume you're experimenting all the time. What is one of your latest experiments just in our last 30 seconds?
You'll laugh. I'm making perfume now.
Perfume?
I have a perfume company, Brooklyn Perfume Company.
Do some of the same principles apply?
The thing that's interesting is the nose part. Because I grew up, in my 20s, tasting wine. And in those days, it wasn't so expensive. You could drink beautifully. You could taste beautiful wines. And I trained my nose that way. When I first started smelling, it just smelled like wine. It didn't smell like anything. And then you keep doing it, and you get nuance. And that was a bit of the training. So it translates well into the perfume thing.
Huh. We'll leave it there now. That's exciting news. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's James Peterson. He's a chef and a James Beard Award-winning food writer and a perfume designer, perfumier. His books include Sauces, Classical and Contemporary Sauce Making, now in its fourth edition. You can check out a couple of the many recipes from that book. We've got them shared over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and let us know your favorite sauce while you're there. Usually people don't want to hear other people talk about their dreams, but I'm going to share one with you. It's a radio-related dream I had just last night. In this dream, I was giving a public talk on behalf of Wisconsin Public Radio, and the main point, this was the takeaway of this speech, was that WPR had to focus on the needs of people listening on a train. Yes, riding a train and listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I felt very strongly about this in my dream. Now I'm awake, as far as I can tell, and I'm curious now, has anyone ever listened to us, listened to WPR while riding on a train? You know, we've got Milwaukee to Chicago, Milwaukee out west. There are trains. There's, you know, the classic trains, too. So if you have ever listened to us on a train, satisfy my curiosity. Please send us an email at ideas@WPR.org. When, how, and why did you listen to us on a train? And if you never have, would you, could you, on a train? Again, email ideas@WPR.org. We'll get Central Time back on the rails after the news.